Support comes from the St. Louis Public Library Foundation. During these challenging times, free access to digital resources is a necessity. You can help our community stay connected. Support your St. Louis Public Library at slpl.org.
This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Sarah Fenske, your host of the monthly Legal Roundtable.
Within 2 years, she had 100% turnover.
There has to be intentional corruption.
Yeah.
And they've got, so is incompetence, is negligence, is, a ship sinking enough?
Is the ship sinking enough? That's a great question. That might be the question.
With the first-degree attempted assault, that's probably as strong as you can do. It's pretty much an attempted murder type claim.
Earlier this month, a Missouri teen rang the wrong doorbell, and the homeowner shot him in the head. Does the Castle Doctrine apply here? What about stand your ground? And in St. Louis, the judges are fed up. Twice in the past week, they've ordered Circuit Attorney Kim Gardner to court to explain why she's not in contempt of court. Yesterday, one moved to find her in indirect contempt. Now, what does that even mean? Well, today we're joined by a panel of top attorneys helping us understand and analyze what's really going on in both of these cases and so much more. And today that includes Sarah Swadesh. She specializes in labor and employment law. She's formerly with the firm Sidey Harper Westhoff. She's now in private practice at the law office of Sarah Swadesh. Sarah, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And we're also joined today by Bill Freivogel. He's an attorney and a professor for the School of Journalism at the Southern Illinois University, Carbondale. Bill, welcome back.
Hi.
And also today, making his Legal Roundtable debut, is Arindam Kaur. Arindam is a shareholder at Polsinelli. He focuses on antitrust compliance, counseling, and government investigations. He also provides outside general counsel services to higher education institutions and emerging entities, and regularly handles pro bono immigration matters. Arindam, we're so happy to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Now, we cannot start anywhere today but the drama surrounding the St. Louis Circuit Attorney's Office. Attorney General Andrew Bailey has filed an action called a quo warranto to remove Kim Gardner from office. But this month, there was a hearing in that case. It felt like all of St. Louis was watching. And that wasn't even the biggest news related to Gardner so far this month. Yesterday, St. Louis Circuit Court Judge Mike Noble moved to find Gardner in contempt of court. This is after prosecutor Chris Dulles twice failed to show up in the case of an 11-year-old girl who was shot. Judge Noble had some blistering words for Gardner. Let's listen.
The question before the court is whether Ms. Gardner and Ms. Dussel's failure to appear on April 10th and April 24th amount to disdain and disrespect for the court. The Circuit Attorney's Office appears to be a rudderless ship of chaos. Ms. Gardner is the circuit attorney, and it is her duty to manage the caseload of each staff member. Mr. Dussel has approximately 104 felony cases. Any prudent practitioner would expect such a caseload to create countless irreconcilable conflicts. It does not appear she has made any reasonable efforts to prevent the resulting chaos. It appears that Ms. Gardner has complete indifference and a conscious disregard for the judicial process. There is sufficient evidence of disdain and disrespect for the judicial process to determine that both Ms. Gardner and Mr. Dussel's conduct support a finding of indirect criminal contempt.
That is Judge Noble, and that is pretty harsh. Now, Arindam, he's talking about indirect contempt of court, indirect criminal contempt. I heard a lot of non-lawyers saying, what the heck is indirect doing in there? What does that even mean?
Yeah, so indirect criminal contempt is basically contempt that doesn't happen in front of the judge or in the courtroom. And so if you look at the order for show cause, it's this issue of the circuit attorney or the assistant circuit attorney not showing up in the courtroom. So ergo, it didn't happen in front of the judge. Because the person never showed up. So that's basically indirect criminal contempt.
So more commonly, is there direct criminal contempt where, say, someone's doing something in the courtroom that the judge finds rises to this same level of offensiveness?
It certainly can. It runs the gamut, and there's discretion for the judge as to what he, she, or they decide to be contempt. But it could be anywhere from outright, refusing to answer a question without the proper basis for not answering a question, or some other conduct that really disrupts the decorum and really shows a disrespect for the court and the proceedings that were happening.
Hmm. So when we talk about a lack of respect for the court, that seems to be Judge Noble is saying by not showing up, this is what Kim Gardner did here, by not having a prosecutor capable of showing up. Bill, what do you make about those words from Judge Noble?
Well, I mean, they're extremely strong and speak for themselves. I mean, when you have Judge Noble saying that about a rudderless ship of chaos. And earlier this month, Booker Shaw, who's been on this panel talking
Absolutely.
About these issues with us before, who's representing the judges in this quo warranto proceeding, saying that the circuit attorney's office is now in a state of near total collapse. I mean, those are strong words, and no one can really claim that these are words of racial animus.
Yeah. Certainly anybody who knows former appellate court Justice Booker Shaw, he's such a soft-spoken man.
Yes.
He's not given to going over the top. To hear that coming out of his mouth, of all people, I felt a chill go down my spine.
Yeah.
I don't know if you had the same
well,
reaction.
I read Tony Messenger's column in the Post-Dispatch where he obviously had that same kind of reaction that, you know, here's a soft-spoken guy who has great respect in the St. Louis legal community, and he's laying it on the line.
So, Sarah, I'm going to give you the tough question here. The judge has said that he is appointing a special prosecutor for this criminal contempt of court matter, and there's now a hearing that is scheduled for May 30th. Do we have any idea of how this process could play out on this contempt charge?
Well, the judge noted that Kim Gardner has her own attorney for the matter, and Attorney Dieslitz doesn't have an attorney yet. So I think he pushed it out to May 30th so that Mr. Dieslitz could get his own attorney on that. But who gets appointed and how that's going to play out, I don't have a crystal ball. I couldn't tell you.
Yeah, this is going to be interesting to watch. A question that I have heard from multiple people. So yesterday in court, even though the judge had ordered this hearing and put Kim Gardner on notice that he was going to consider that she was in contempt of court, I believe he gave like 1 week notice that he wanted the circuit attorney's office to send a representative to come in to answer to this charge. In addition to Kim Gardner's personal attorney, she designated a circuit attorney in that office to show up. And this designee, by all accounts, seemed very unprepared to talk about this case. He hadn't read the probable cause statement in it. He wasn't up to speed on the terms of it. We got a question from Twitter. Why did Kim Gardner prep her personal attorney for the contempt hearing, yet didn't give her designee, this assistant circuit attorney, any info at all? He looked like a fourth grader lying about homework. The judge seemed to wonder if Gardner was taking this seriously, sending that guy in unprepared. If she did indeed send this guy in unprepared, do you think that was a strategic error, Arundam?
It would have been nice had he been prepared. I think this gets to more of the practical ramifications of where that office is right now. There's so few people, whether it's the executive group or the line prosecutors, and you know, to add another hearing on the circuit attorney's docket, if you will, in May 30th, it does sort of beg the question, how will they be prepared for that? But it also raises this larger question that I think all lawyers appreciate, which is the contempt hearing aside, there's just this basic ethical requirement of being competent and ready for cases, being an officer of the court, and also being a representative of your clients in this case. And I think there's multiple sort of ethical issues here that are really coming to the surface here, along with the hearing that the judge has ordered.
Sarah?
Yeah, I would agree with Arundam. The lack of staff and the lack of qualified attorneys is not a new problem. I was going back and researching when these issues started percolating, and she was elected in November 2016, took office in 2017, and within 2 years, she had 100% turnover. Mm-hmm. It's astronomical. Even as recently, when she took the office, she had 58 prosecutors. She now has 30. and the people that have come in and replaced the people who have left were rookies. No offense to rookies, but rookies need to be trained. And so it's not just a lack of staff, it's a lack of experience. And so I suspect that Kim Gardner looks at this hearing and says, I only have 30 attorneys. I need to dedicate them on, I think the judge noted, Mr. Dislitz had 104 felonies. So she looks at this, I assume, at least I hope so, as triage. Mm-hmm. She says, I need to put my attorneys on the murders and the felonies and the robberies. And if I go into this hearing not prepared, Mr. Downey, her private attorney, will sort of cover for her because he's got, I assume he doesn't have 104 cases, much less felonies.
I hope not.
And he has the time and attention to give it, whereas her staff doesn't. So I assume giving her, you know, benefit of the doubt, she triaged as best she could and it wasn't good enough.
You're making an excellent point there, and you're giving me some sympathy for how they handled this. But thinking almost like a politician here, I can't believe I'm thinking like a politician. But if I were Kim Gardner, I think I would have been tempted to come in and just come in so humbly and just tell the judge, hey, we screwed up. We're doing everything we can to hold things together, and personally have come in versus choosing a designee who didn't have time to get up to speed on this case. Bill, would that have been a disastrous call on my part?
Well, I don't think so, although you would have subjected yourself to immediate action, possibly. And probably she thought that Michael Downey, who is a very competent lawyer, I actually went to law school with him, and I know he's a really smart guy, and probably thought that he would be able to speak to the issues, which the judge did not permit him to do. But what Sarah laid out, you know, this sort of falling apart of the circuit attorney's office. I mean, it's tragic for St. Louis and for Kim Gardner and for you know, victims of crime who aren't getting the justice out of the courts. I mean, Kim Gardner getting elected was one of the biggest results of Ferguson. I mean, that happened because of the political coalition that was put together as a result of and after Ferguson. And she was one of a couple of scores of progressive prosecutors elected across the country. And now, I mean, it's just the people who supported her. I supported her.
Sure.
The people who supported her after her election and her progressive policies, can't do that anymore because of the incompetence.
Sarah, you, when I was suggesting Kim Gardner should personally show up, you had a look of pure horror across your face. Why would that have been a bad idea?
Well, we want people to be accountable for their misconduct or their accidents, and I don't think Kim Gardner has a record of that. So as I was doing this prior research, she had the 100% turnover as of 2019, and she was quoted saying, essentially, I'm not going to miss them.
Ooh.
She said, for the people who left, I'm not missing them. All right. She's not sad that they're gone. But then even as what gets into the quo warranto issue, mistakes are being made, cases are being dismissed. And Kim Gardner, instead of acknowledging that she's responsible for the staff, she says, it was my staff's fault. They didn't schedule it. They didn't dock it. They did something else. And so I think she's not holding herself accountable. But to her benefit of the doubt, I don't know many politicians that do. And so I think my look of horror was, that's not what a politician would do, but that's what we want her to do.
We do need to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to dive right back into this case, maybe hear from some of you, and dig into a few more of the issues at the circuit attorney's office. And after that, we're going to get into that horrifying criminal case in Kansas City. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio. Welcome back. I'm Sarah Fenske, your host of the monthly Legal Roundtable. I have three great attorneys with me today. That includes Sarah Swadesh, who's at the law office of Sarah Swadesh, Arindam Kaur, who's a shareholder at Polsinelli, Bill Freivogel, who's an attorney and a professor for the School of Journalism at Southern Illinois University, Carbondale. Now, just before the break, we were talking about all the problems at the St. Louis Circuit Attorney's Office, and I believe Sarah talked about that Circuit Attorney Gardner's defense in these matters
lawyers was if these things happened, and I'm not saying they did, but if they happened, these were the fault of my underlings, that I did not personally dismiss these cases. I am not the one who made these calls. Therefore, I can't be removed from office in this quo warranto action because of these things. Well, the Riverfront Times had a very interesting story in the days before the hearing that an assistant circuit attorney coming out and saying, from her perspective, that's not true. She said that senior staff would robo-sign her name to dismissals and other motions that she didn't even know about. She ended up quitting the office, had some very harsh words for Kim Gardner. But is this specific issue of senior staff signing these types of motions on behalf of more junior staffers, Arindam, is that potentially a problem? And is it a problem for Gardner's defense?
It could be a potential problem. You can certainly do e-signatures. And for those of us that are filing, whether it's federal or state court, depending on where you are, you can give consent to someone else to do the e-signature on your behalf on a case because you're not there, whether that's your legal assistant or whomever. The rules require that you have a copy of a contemporaneous copy of your actual signing as a backup on your file. And so I think what the issue is going to be raised here is if this assistant circuit attorney saying, listen, there were cases that were being dismissed with my name on it. I didn't know about it. And it's because senior staff did it. I think the question is, was there some sort of documentation that this is allowed given the staffing issues? And there was explicit consent that this could happen. Are there actual case files that show the signatures? And I think where this might lead to, going back to the quo warranto case or pending, is as they are starting to move through discovery, could that be another issue that could either strengthen or weaken that case for AG Bailey? Is there something from Kim Gardner that says, hey, this is you have to consent, or is there nothing there?
Yeah.
And so as we're talking about issues of are there specific instances of that can be pointed directly to the circuit attorney as opposed to the assistant circuit attorneys. I think this is one issue that I think we're just going to have to see what the documentation looks like.
It is interesting. I talked to somebody who had been a prosecutor under Jennifer Joyce, the predecessor of Kim Gardner, and I said, I get that prosecutors are busy. Is it possible that this is just how they have to handle things due to the volume? And he said this would have never happened under Jennifer Joyce, that she always got their consent before doing anything under their name. But that's just one perspective. Sarah, what do you make of this?
Well, I would want to see what's getting filed, right? Is it a standard certificate of service? Is it just a notice of a hearing that the attorney already knows about? Or is it some sort of motion to compel? Or is it an indictment? I would want to know what's getting filed under the attorney's name because, the sort of importance of the document would matter. It would matter to me as the attorney. It would matter in all respects. And so we don't know Natalia Ogurtsky.
Ogurkowitz.
Ogurkowitz.
I practiced for that.
Yeah.
She's clearly a disgruntled worker. I mean, she is throwing Kim Gardner under the bus in every way possible. And so is this an exaggeration? I would want to know more details. But in and of itself, if it's a sort of run-of-the-mill filing, it doesn't cause me any heartburn. And frankly, to some degree, it could have cleared their caseload a little bit.
I mean, I think one thing to keep sort of a bottom line thing to keep in mind on the quo warranto proceeding is that only two prosecutors have been thrown out under quo warranto. And they were involved in, like looking the other way, our complicity with gangsters. I mean, and so the argument, that Kim Gardner is making is that there has to be intentional corruption.
Yeah.
And they've got, so is incompetence, is negligence, is, a ship sinking enough?
That's a great question. That might be the question.
I don't think it actually is. I mean, maybe this will be the case that determines it is enough. But that's why she wants to keep her fingerprints off of it, off of stuff.
Yeah. That completely makes sense to me. This quo warranto case, this had kind of been the big headline of the month until everything that went down yesterday. What struck you in sort of the follow-up of everything that Appellate Justice John Torbitsky, who's running this matter, do we get any sense of whether he's taking this case seriously? I've heard from a number of attorneys on this panel saying, they'll never hit that standard. Do you get that sense from him?
I think he's taking this very serious. He's got a subpoena in front of him for 54 issues. The city attorney's office hasn't done anything to gather these documents, to gather the information. I think he's looking at it very seriously. My guess is the trial is set for September of 23. My gut is nobody really wants a ruling. It's not good for the – this kind of reminds me of the Rams litigation. So many attorneys, so many parties. But at the end, at least the city, you know, got some benefit, reward, some money out of it. At the end of this, taxpayers are just paying everybody everywhere. So I do think it's being taken serious. But I think Kim Gardner's probably going to stall till the next election and
who see what happens.
I can't fathom she runs again.
No, I agree. I think the judge is absolutely taking this seriously. I think the motion to dismiss is still pending, so there is that big sort of dispositive issue of whether it amounts to a legal claim that can be moved forward. But I think, as Bill said, Tony Messenger's article really kind of encapsulated the issue here of the mix of the legal and the political. Nobody wants to see this go to trial. At the end of the day, there's the pursuit of justice, justice for the victims, justice for the accused, and that's all at a standstill right now until this gets sort of resolved.
Mm-hmm. We should note Kim Gardner has said that she's going to run again. There are a lot of people who suspect that that is bluffing and that she's not going to run again, but that is her officially stated position. Bill?
I wouldn't be surprised if she ran again, and I wouldn't be surprised if she were elected.
Wow.
I mean, you can run. You can do a pretty good job of running against. The Whitey Turner General is coming after me.
That can be popular in the city, and then there are sometimes reasons for that. If you have a question about these legal matters before us, you can call us at 314-382-8255. That's 382-TALK. I want to bring it back to this criminal contempt for just a moment. Assistant circuit attorney named Alex Polta texted a supervisor a couple weeks ago, "Kim's conduct at the end of last week is fairly indefensible. I half expect her to be in jail before my vacation ends." Now, obviously, it's very hard for anybody to be sent to jail, but that is a possibility in criminal contempt of court. A judge can kind of just order you to jail. Bill, do you think there's any chance of that happening here?
I guess I think it's probably unlikely, and it would probably only turn her into it'd probably help her politically.
Yeah, in St. Louis, we can all identify with having been in jail. So, yeah, that can only help. We've got a tweet from Philip. If Kim Gardner is found to be in contempt, and let's say she goes to jail, how will she be replaced? I want to clarify something here, and you guys stop me if I'm wrong. If she goes to jail for contempt, that does not necessarily mean that she's no longer circuit attorney. That would probably be a very short stay for a judge to make a point. Her being removed from office is, I believe, a completely separate issue. I see some nods from my panel. Yes.
Yeah.
But the question of how she'll be replaced, this is a very interesting question. It's been said many times that this would be Governor Parson's selection. However, my friend Bill McClellan was pointing out, after apparently talking to former Supreme Court Justice Mike Wolf, that there is some precedent that in the past, the Mayor Vince Schemel, managed to pull a switcheroo and get somebody to step down from one of these types of offices and managed to get his replacement in there. Is there a chance this wouldn't be Governor Parson's pick? Because, boy, that would be a lot more palatable.
I don't think Parson wants to make a pick, right? Who wants to step into this job and clean this up when they know there's an election, 18 months or 6 months away, and you're just a placeholder and you're not going to win the election? Nobody wants this job. Yeah. I mean, no appointee is going to want the job. So I don't think that's Parson's real goal here.
I want to go to the phone lines. Karen is calling from St. Louis. Karen, hi, you're on St. Louis on the air.
Hi. I think the issues and problems in the prosecutor's office are certainly concerning, but I also think there's a lot of piling on and shark smelling blood in the water. I mean, even when Ms. Gardner first took office, there were those who wanted to see her fail as a progressive prosecutor and as a woman of color. And I mean, there were problems in that office before she took office. Let's not forget the Megan Boeken, Cornell McKay tragedy and travesty. And I think there are issues in her office, but it also seems like there are people who are very happy to see this happen. I mean, she called out a number of St. Louis police officers.
Karen, you make an excellent point there, and it's hard to argue with the thing you're saying. I know there are a lot of people who rooted for her failure here. And when you talk about the problems before she came on, that terrible shooting in the Central West End that Karen referenced, Jennifer Joyce certainly did have her detractors.
Yes, I mean, I'd like to sort of support what the caller said. I mean, we forget that. I mean, but for Kim Gardner, Greitens would have remained governor, most likely. I mean, she didn't handle that prosecution perfectly, but for her prosecution, I think he would have survived. Lamar Johnson, that wasn't that long ago.
This was a man who had been wrongly imprisoned for decades, and she got him out.
And she got him out, and she did it. You know, she had to fight through a lot of legal battles to do that, and eventually the state legislature changed the law. So, there are things to say in her favor, calling out police officers who were not any longer going to be called as witnesses because they had track records of lying.
Yeah. Karen, thank you for that call. I feel like Karen made an excellent point there. There's one last Gardner-related thing I want to talk to my panel about very quickly, and that is that now the idea is being floated. There's some regional leaders who are coming up with this idea that with all the chaos and disarray, that maybe we could have some legislation that would combine the St. Louis City Circuit Attorney's Office with the St. Louis County Prosecuting Attorney Office being run by Wesley Bell. Arindam, you were very involved in that Better Together effort that sought to merge some duplicative city-county functions. Do you think there's any chance, from a policy standpoint, that anybody could pull off this sort of merger?
One, in terms of timing within this session, unlikely. And then I think it's a larger question. So the city-county plan that came out in 2019 was really looking at not just the prosecutor, but the judicial districts. So combining the county and the city, the 21st and 22nd. And there's a lot of pieces that come to that, not just having a single prosecutor, which, again, was part of that plan. So I understand that this is a potential solution that's being floated. And I think it's, again, a lot to do with the operations of, we need to have a strong office in the city to continue to prosecute. The question is this the best solution? Or, there are rules where, the governor can ask the attorney general or an assistant attorney general to aid and support any county prosecutor, which is what the circuit attorney is, the county prosecutor for the city. So
there might be less dramatic,
yes, I think so,
organizational things. Bill?
It'd be much more palatable, though, if Wesley Bell were the prosecutor over the city and the county. I mean, he is a progressive prosecutor who's doing a good job.
Yeah.
I agree. It's tough in the 2 weeks before the end of the legislative session. Steve Ellman, who was one of the county St. Louis St. Charles County executive who was one of those pitching this, thought it maybe could be done. It'd have to get, put onto some sort of related bill. I don't know.
Fascinating to think of the legislature managing to do this in a way that would actually be done properly with the right T's crossed and the right I's dotted. I don't know that I have any faith in that. Sarah, what's your take on this trial balloon being floated?
It makes me a little nervous because it feels like piecemeal together. Right. Instead of just sort of solving and taking all of it's like when we make bad streets that go in every direction because we're not road planning.
And we love doing that in St. Louis.
Well, since we're never going to get better together, why not do piecemeal together?
There you go.
We are talking today to our legal roundtable. That is attorney Bill Freivogel. We're also joined by Sarah Swadesh and Arindam Kaur. We do need to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about something other than the St. Louis Circuit Attorney's Office, believe it or not. There's just an awful case in Kansas City that may invoke stand your ground. There's also a lawsuit challenging the Attorney General's regulations on transgender care. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio.
Thank you.
Welcome back. I'm Sarah Fenske, your host of the monthly Legal Roundtable, and I'm joined today by Bill Freivogel. He's an attorney and a professor for the School of Journalism at Southern Illinois University Carbondale. We're also joined by Arindam Kaur, who's a shareholder at Polsinelli, and Sarah Swadesh, who is in private practice at the law office of Sarah Swadesh. Now, we're going to talk about a very disturbing case here. Just want to warn people. 2 weeks ago, a teenager in Kansas City was sent to pick up his younger siblings. He went to Northeast 115th Street instead of Northeast 115th Terrace. And the homeowner shot him in the arm and also shot him in the head. 16-year-old Ralph Jarl has somehow survived. And days later, his 84-year-old shooter has been charged with assault in the first degree and armed criminal action. Sarah Swadesh, this is obviously a very serious criminal matter here. Do these seem like appropriate charges in this case?
Absolutely. Absolutely. From what I understand, the teenager gets lost. He rings the doorbell. So he didn't just walk into the dwelling. Lester, the shooter, opens up the front door and then shoots him once through the glass. And then I don't know where the facts go from there, but either stands over him and shoots him again or shoots him through the glass door. I'm not sure which, but I don't see where the stand your ground or castle doctrine will come in. I don't see that self-defense.
So in this case, this teenager was black and this shooter is an 84-year-old white man. There's been some talk, I believe, even from the prosecutor in this case, that he believes there may have been a racial component, is how he described it. Bill, what would it take to elevate these charges to a hate crime designation?
Well, I think the Justice Department could certainly investigate this as a hate crime.
That would require the feds to come in.
The feds to come in, and you know, the facts would certainly seem to support this. I mean, I think of the sort of the case of the jogger in Georgia, you know, where there was a
Ahmaud Arbery.
Yes, but you know, I think that this the defendant will use stand your ground and castle doctrine to defend himself if it goes to a trial. You know, he said he opened the interior door, saw a black male 6 feet tall pulling the exterior storm door handle, although the young man says he didn't do that. He stated he believed someone was attempting to break into the house and shot twice within seconds of opening the door.
Does Missouri law, can you argue under Missouri law that if I am seeing this, and again, this young man says he did not do this, but if you're saying, hey, I saw him do this, and you reasonably believe that you saw him do that, does that give you a get-out-of-jail-free card here? So, Arindam?
Well, I think what is interesting about the stand your ground law, and this is happening across the state across the country in terms of trends of modifying that law, there used to be an obligation to retreat. Mm-hmm. So different from the castle doctrine, but your stand your ground, and now there is no obligation to retreat. And so I agree with Bill. It'll absolutely be used as a defense. The questions will be very specific, you know, the reasonable belief. Was there an actual movement of entering into the dwelling under the castle doctrine? So those are all things that I think are going to be relevant. And then to Bill's point on the hate laws, a couple of issues. One, the Missouri hate law is not as strong as the federal one, and I can understand why the prosecutor is not pushing the state law for that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, if the Justice Department does look at it, I think there is the federal hate crime statute definitely could be applicable here. So we'll have to see what they want to do.
Okay, so under the Missouri state law, which is all this county prosecutor could charge under, there's tougher elements he'd have to satisfy.
It's not so much tougher elements as that the liability and the sentencings are lower, mm-hmm. and they're applied to lower crimes to enhance the penalty. But with the first degree attempted assault, that's as probably as strong as you can do. It's pretty much an attempted murder type claim.
So. Okay, so it already makes it so strong that that would hardly even help.
Exactly.
You're saying okay,
exactly.
That's interesting. Boy, this case is just horrible. And an interesting note here is that unlike most St. Louis defendants these days, this shooter, who we know was pretty quick to shoot and ask questions later, he was let out on bond. Now, on the other hand, this guy's 84 years old. Sarah, do you think it's appropriate in this case?
Boy, he told the investigator he was scared to death. He said Mr. Jarl, the victim, was a 6-foot-tall, big man. Lester says, I'm 84. I'm kind of feeble. I was scared. Do I think it's appropriate? Given his age, probably. Yeah. If he would have been 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, I just said, I don't know. I'm not saying he's innocent, but given his age at 84, I don't really see him being a flight risk or a hazard to necessarily other people.
I sure hope they take his guns away.
Yes, I would hope they take his guns, but I was not astonished or appalled that he would be on bond.
I think this is the struggle of a prosecutor in doing the legal job, but also the political job, yeah. Right? And that's where I think this is really tough. You know, they noted that race is a factor, mm-hmm. And that will play out here. But it was a tough situation, but I don't know. I think race had a factor here.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Just based on based on his own description of what happened here, the fact he noted the race
yep.
of the person he shot. This was central for him. And I imagine, I was joking about I sure hope they took his guns away, but I was also serious about that. That would be pretty typical for somebody who's out on a pretrial release, correct? They're going to, at that point, abridge your Second Amendment rights to blow away anybody who comes to your front porch.
I'd hope so.
We should look into this. That might be a good follow-up.
You certainly don't have a Second Amendment right to have a gun after you've been arrested on this charge.
That's a good point. He's been charged with a felony. If he's convicted, he's not going to get to have these guns again. All right, let's talk about another matter. Now, with the stroke of a pen, Missouri Attorney General Andrew Bailey promulgated an emergency order placing regulations on people pursuing gender-affirming care earlier this month. And that, unsurprisingly, led to a lawsuit. This suit was filed by the ACLU and Lambda Legal. Sarah, what's the gist of their argument here?
Well, they have a couple. The first is there's no emergency. This care, this care that's health care that's been given, it's been out there for 20, 30 years. So there is no emergency. And then the second sort of underlying concern is it will lead to a discontinuation of care because the rule, the Attorney General said the rule was for children because we need to protect children, but in reality the rule applies to children and adults, and so there's a concern that care will stop because the rule requires 3 years of confirmed dysphoria body delusions and at least 15 hours of mental health care, and there will be a screening for autism.
For autism, yeah.
Yes. So I think there's a couple concerns, and one of them is the sort of biggest one is the Attorney General brought the lawsuit under the Missouri Merchandising Purchases Act, and he says I have the authority to implement rules when there is a fraud on the consumer, and so the Missouri Merchandising Act is traditionally been for like lemon laws, like I bought a bad car from the dealer, I need my money back, or some sort of fraud or misleading consumer practices. So it's usually aimed at the purchase of like household items. But he claims he has the right to implement rules under that statute, which I don't think he's wrong, but does gender affirming healthcare fall under that statute?
Yeah, that seems like quite a stretch. The Missouri Merchandising Practices Act governs healthcare. Bill, were you surprised to see that was his grounds here?
Yes, that seemed like a weak grounds. I don't believe that law has ever been used to tell doctors how to practice medicine. Bailey is beyond actually, some of the other Republican supporters of limits on transgender care in extending this to adults.
Yeah. Jay Ashcroft himself.
Jay Ashcroft. Governor Parson himself yesterday said he wouldn't go that far.
Interesting.
That people, adults should be able to make their own decisions. So, yes.
a very odd order by Andrew Bailey, who we should note is, trying to hold this office he was appointed to. He has gotten a lot of headlines out of this.
You know, what I found hard to follow was he's defending this as that he wanted all patients to have access to the information necessary to make health decisions that can have long-term deleterious health consequences. I mean, he's sort of like portraying this as, I'm the friend of the patient. I think he'd find a lot of difficulty finding any patients who would want to welcome his friendship on this issue.
Yeah, and yesterday he did run into some headwinds. This was a very busy day in courts. There were multiple courts involved for the litigants on this matter. Andrew Bailey felt like kind of at the last minute was trying to get this move to federal court. That move did end up failing. Sarah, what do you think was his thinking in trying to get this from state court to federal court?
I think he thinks he will have a more favorable venue in federal court.
Do you think that's a fair assessment?
I think traditionally it's been perceived that the federal court is more conservative. There's more Republican appointees. There's more recognition of religious liberties in federal court. I think in state court he would perceive it as to be more liberal-leaning or progressive. Mm-hmm.
Because we should note the ACLU did file this lawsuit in St. Louis County. So this would be a change from St. Louis County, which is fairly Democratic, to a much broader swath of the state.
Yeah. So I think he thought he would have a federal, a more friendly venue bench. And District Court Autry stated, you can't just file something in federal court just because you want to be in federal court. So Judge Autry slapped the Attorney General down pretty good on that, and I think sent it back to the state court within 24 hours
he
or 40 hours.
So fast.
Yeah.
I'm always so thrilled anytime Judge Autry gets a high profile case, because he just has a way with words. I really admire that man. Bill, he did not mince words or waste his time on this one.
No, he didn't. And you know, the ACLU, when I looked at their complaint, it seemed like they had been careful not to be making big federal constitutional claims.
You know, maybe just for this reason.
Maybe just for this reason.
So this ends up back in St. Louis County. And again, this is all happening very quickly. At this point, it gets assigned to Judge Ellen Roboto. And she ended up saying that she had, quote, not had the opportunity to review the briefing sufficiently to fully rule on the motion, which, fair point, she gets handed it and she's being asked to rule, I think, that same day. Do you think Bailey hurt his chances of getting the swift action that he needed to try to shut down this kind of healthcare going on with these federal court machinations, Bill?
Well, it probably didn't help, and I would be surprised if Ellen Roboto didn't end up issuing a more permanent stay after reviewing it.
She's going to block these regulations.
That's what I would expect. I'd be surprised if she didn't.
So, Sarah, do you also see that the ACLU and Lambda Legal, they have a good likelihood of success on this lawsuit?
Well, first of all, if I were Attorney General Bailey, I would have done the same thing. I would have removed it to federal court. I don't think he prejudiced himself in front of the St. Louis County Circuit Court. Our circuit court judges see removals all the time. They see remands all the time. They understand it's part of the procedural process. I don't think that he offended any circuit judge. And I don't think he would be particularly surprised that any judge, whether it's federal or state, would say, give me a few more days to look at this. As far as Lambda Legal ACLU's chances of winning, if I were to go to Vegas, I would put my chip on the ACLU's case. He makes interesting arguments, but I think he's a little outside the scope of the Missouri Merchandising Practices Act. I think he would have been better suited going through a different avenue, a different statute. But I'm guessing this is the one that he thought was the most expeditious. And so that's why he chose it. But I suspect he will take a second bite at this apple. He will find a better suited statute. And I think he probably does have a better chance of prevailing down the road, but not not with this statute.
And in the meantime, the legislature is trying to do its own interventions in terms of healthcare on these issues. So this is not a one-front fight. Talk about being offended here. Let's talk about a lawsuit in Springfield from some offended educators. They were trying to challenge the diversity, equity, and inclusion training at their district. Their lawsuit kind of turned into a disaster for these two teachers. This was a first-in-the-nation lawsuit over mandatory anti-racism training. But a federal judge ruled in January that these two Springfield Public School employees had been unable to show the district punished them for exercising their right to free speech during this training. Now, this past month, the judge ruled that they must pay the district's $313,000 in attorney's fees. The Southeastern Legal Foundation, which was their lawyers on this case, they say that's never happened in their 50 years of civil rights claims. Arindam, is this as unusual as this right-wing civil rights law firm is trying to claim here?
It is unusual. I mean, it's not, unless it's specifically allowed by statute, attorney's fees are usually borne by the parties here. But clearly the judge looking at the case and dismissing it on summary judgment and then having a chance to look at the request thought that it was so frivolous that it warranted a message. And this is clearly a message. And I don't think this chills the free speech movement and meritorious lawsuits, but it really does hopefully give lawyers a second chance to really consider, is this a good faith argument? Are we doing something that makes sense here? And hopefully we'll clear up the docket from some of these cases.
Now, Sarah, lawyers like you, you're kind of dependent on trying to get your legal fees in some cases. What do you make of this ruling?
I wouldn't say I'm the plaintiff's lawyers are dependent on the attorney's fees. But what they really do is, if there's a low-wage income worker who maybe is not getting their overtime pay, they're entitled to $10.50 an hour, but they're only getting $9.50 or they're not getting their overtime, the attorney's fees provision is to ensure that a lawyer will take the case so that if they were successful, they can be compensated. It's also to dissuade companies from taking advantage of that. Well, who's going to take your case for just a dollar or $10 or $1,000? The companies know it would be difficult. When I first read the opinion, it made me moderately nervous, only because civil rights, whether it's for 1983 or race discrimination or gender discrimination or unpaid wages, it made me a little bit nervous that it would chill the rights of people who want to come forward and prosecute their claims, that they might say, oh, wow, I in good faith believe this, but what if I get the judge who has a history of whatever. What if I get a bad pull on a judge?
A judge who just doesn't like your cause, maybe.
A judge who doesn't like the cause, a judge who whatever. Whether it be a religious liberty case or a race discrimination case, what if I have a judge on the opposite side? Or what if I have a judge that doesn't like my lawyer?
Yeah.
Right? I think it definitely made me pause and say, well, it's highly unusual that these sort of reverse fee shift where the defendant or the company gets their fees. But it definitely made me pause. It made me pause, not as to the types of claims I would necessarily bring, but if I were an average citizen out there and I heard, oh man, not only did I lose, but I had to pay $313,000 to the other side.
Yeah, there's a chilling effect there.
I would if I were the average person, I'd be a little concerned.
Bill, what do you make of this?
Well, I agree. I mean, I think probably the first reaction of maybe a liberal traditional civil rights lawyer would be, oh, ha ha, you know, this happy to see the comeuppance for this conservative legal group and their claim that, oh, you're forcing me to the study about diversity and exclusion and inclusion. But, you know, if you think about how, I mean, the law has got to have a rule that applies to everybody. Mm-hmm. And so if it's applying to these conservative, quote unquote, civil rights lawyers, it's going to get applied to traditional civil rights lawyers, too. So I think it's a little bit. It could be a little bit dangerous. And we'll see whether it could get appealed.
You know? So, Arindam, in our final minute here, I'm going to give you the last word on this one. Any thoughts?
I was just going to say that I certainly appreciate the point they're bringing, but I think the facts here and the issue of where was the harm, which is the judge kept on asking. They still had their job. They had their say against the issue. And I think so this is perhaps an exception to what may be a trend. And so, again, I'm comfortable with what happened here.
It'll be interesting to see what happens if they do try to appeal this to appellate court. We'll talk about it on a future legal roundtable. And Sarah, I'm sorry, we're out of time. I can't give you the rebuttal. That clock is my master, and I've got to follow it. So Arundhem Kaur, I want to thank you so much making your legal roundtable debut. Arundhem is a shareholder at Polsinelli. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for the opportunity.
And Bill Freivogel, attorney and professor at the School of Journalism at Southern Illinois University, Carbondale, thank you.
Thanks.
And Sarah Swadesh, sorry, ran out of time, in private practice at the law office of Sarah Swadesh, thank you.
I'll give Arundhem an earful afterwards.
The hallway's going to be fun.
Today's episode was produced by Alex Hoyer.
Audio engineering and podcast design by Aaron Dork.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Our podcast proudly supports St. Louis artists by using music from Life Creative Group.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thanks.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri, St. Louis.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.